I really believe that, you know, we did take a few steps back because of those statements.
The Fairbanks police chief apologizes for statements made after the Fairbanks Four were released. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, December 23rd. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a big success for a Juno fundraiser.
It really ensures that we're going to be able to meet our mission of providing everyone in need of food, shelter, and compassion.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
Condor Airlines, with nonstop service from Ted Stevens International Airport to Germany and beyond. More information available on condor.com. Condor, born to fly.
And by
ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
Fairbanks City Police Chief has apologized for statements made last week about the legal settlement that vacated the long-contested murder convictions of the Fairbanks Four, the Native men who served 18 years in jail for the 1997 beating death of John Hartman. As KUAC's Dan Bross reports, Chief Randall Aragon also committed to further investigation of the case.
Fairbanks City Police Chief Randall Aragon retracted comments made last week about the Fairbanks Four settlement, including that it resulted from political pressure and is a vindication of police and prosecutors' handling of the John Hartman murder case.
You know, I could go on and on and on and apologize. You know, words are like bullets. They're, once fired, they're almost impossible to recover. I always say that. But I want you to know this. My heart was there. My heart is with the Native community.
Aragon also reversed his earlier assertion that the 1997 Hartman murder case is closed. City Mayor John Eberhardt emphasized instead that police will be following up on new information brought forward during a Fairbanks 4 post-conviction relief hearing this fall. Eberhardt says that includes alternate Hartman murder suspects William Holmes and Jason Wallace, men already in prison for 2002 drug killings, who are also being investigated for possible involvement in the 2002 unsolved stabbing death of Fairbanks resident Mahogany Davis.
As part of the Mahogany Davis murder investigation, I've asked Chief Aragon to speak with William Holmes about Mahogany's murder and also the Hartman murder. William Holmes had a child with Mahogany Davis. And, you know, you hear little bits and pieces of information and the names Holmes and Wallace come up in a number of contexts of homicides or unsolved homicides in our community.
Mayor Eberhardt additionally committed to pursuing an independent review of Fairbanks police handling of the Hartman case. The mayor's statements and Chief Aragon's apology were accepted by Fairbanks Native Association Director Steve Guinness, but he emphasized questions remain about local and state handling of the Fairbanks 4 case.
And we will continue to work on those. We will continue to try to find some resolve to those questions. It doesn't stop with the release of these men.
Another Native community leader, Dorothy Shockley, emphasized after the press conference that Police Chief Aragon's statements last week were damaging.
I really believe that, you know, we did take a few steps back because of those statements.
Shockley, who's related to Fairbanks 4 member Marvin Roberts, says the case points to the continuing issue of racism.
And as the Native community, you know, that's what we're telling people. You know, there is racism. We are treated differently. And unfortunately, a lot of times it's not in a good way.
Shockley says she'll have to see action, not just words, to believe positive change is happening at the police department. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Five Juno Native dance groups organized a fundraiser Monday night, which raised about $32,000 for the Capital City Shelter and Soup Kitchen. About 400 people attended, contributing money to the Glory Hole through donations, silent auction, fry bread sales, dancing raffle, and a $9,500 matching donation from the Rasmussen Foundation. Nancy Barnes is head of the Yetsk'u dance group. She helped organize the fundraiser with Colleen James, who was inspired by a Juno Empire story on the Glory Hole's financial deficit. Barnes was blown away by how much money the event raised in 2 hours.
I don't think anybody thought we were going to make that much money. Somebody said, "What's your goal?" And I was saying, if we raise $5,000 just to help them have a wonderful Christmas, that'll be great.
The Central Council of Tlingit and Haida Indian Tribes of Alaska helped put on the fundraiser. It donated planning space and the Elizabeth Paradovich Hall for the event. President Richard Peterson says the Central Council was happy to help.
Our culture is kind of about holding each other up, and the Glory Hole is an entity that's always holding our people up. So, you know, it's time when they're hurting to give back and help them out.
Glory Hole Executive Director Maria Lovashuk says the funds raised Monday night, plus other donations, will close the $58,000 deficit the shelter was in. Lovashuk says the deficit was largely due to a burst pipe that flooded and closed down the shelter last December. The inside of the building had to be rebuilt. The shelter has also been focusing more on getting the Housing First project built than on fundraising. Lovashuk says she can't say thank you enough to the dance groups, community organizers, and people who contributed to Monday's fundraiser.
This is beyond gratitude. This was a really amazing thing. And it really ensures that we're going to be able to meet our mission of providing everyone in need of food, shelter, and compassion. And it also means that we'll keep on working on the Juno Housing First project and making it a reality.
Lovashuk says it's an honor to be supported by the Alaska Native community and to start the new year on a positive note. The Veterans Administration in Alaska has made enormous strides in the last few years connecting veterans with benefits and health care. But serious problems remain. Yesterday, we brought you the first part of a story about Scott Harrison, a veteran who fell into poverty while stranded between operations. One hurdle for Harrison was not being able to get a copy of his service treatment record. In this second part of the story, KSKA's Zachariah Hughes explains where that record is and what it means for Harrison going forward.
To find out where Scott's service record could be, I sat down with Forrest.
Forrest E. Powell III.
The perpetually cheery program manager for the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs. That name can be confusing. Even though it's got VA in the title, DMVA is not part of the Federal Veterans Administration. They work for the state as a kind of liaison between veterans living in Alaska and the national VA. And they are master explainers when it comes to breaking down a system that can generously be described as Byzantine.
A veteran has to have a service-connected disability to be eligible for VA benefits.
If Scott is going to prove that his injuries are connected to his time in the service, the section of the VA handling benefits, the VBA, needs to comb through his service treatment record, which, given his time as a Marine in the 80s, presents problems.
There's a group that did not serve during a war period, and that was right after Vietnam and just before the Gulf War. I call it the donut hole.
Powell calls it that because the consistency in record keeping at the time varied, and veterans are often confronted with gaps in what can look like a complete service record. But what Scott believed was that the VA could not find his file. In fact, after weeks of searching for what could have happened to Scott's service record, I finally found out it does exist. The VA in Alaska has had it since at least the 90s. Chad Pomelow manages the Veterans Service Center in the Anchorage VA office.
The bigger challenge is when we can't track down records.
But in this case, you have a record.
Yes.
It took me almost a month to confirm Scott's service record existed. The request was routed through an office in Portland, Oregon. And in the end, I didn't see Scott's record, but I did get authorization to discuss it with Pomelow. He tells me Scott filed an application for a service-connected injury through VBA in 1996 and was denied a few months later. According to the summary, doctors didn't find compelling evidence that the back injury was service-related.
I will say that if they didn't go get documentation of an injury, then we're not going to have evidence of it.
When I asked Scott about the benefits claim, he tells me he doesn't remember seeing the denial, which he thinks would have been an essential piece of information to have.
I've definitely made enough noise about it. I've definitely called all over about it.
And so who do you talk with at the VA about this stuff?
I've talked with social workers. I've talked with the doctors. I've talked with members of the primary care team. My understanding is it has been voiced up to the highest levels in the VA here.
Scott says he has spent an enormous amount of time trying to locate his record and has never held a copy of it. He's not alone. The scale of this problem in Alaska depends on who you talk to. Steve Harrison, no relation to Scott, is chairman of the Veterans Party of Alaska, a political group. It took him 11 years to establish his own benefits, and that, he says, is not uncommon. Harrison estimates that among his daily interactions with veterans over Facebook pages and websites, 95% have had a problem applying for benefits. He says the most frequent issue that he hears about is that a service record can't be found.
That's one of their favorite excuses, is to lie straight to the veteran's face saying that they lost them, and that's not true. So we wind up suffering and dying needlessly.
Harrison's take is an extreme. On the other side are veteran service officers, people employed by veterans groups to act as intermediaries between a claim-seeking veteran and the VA. Service officer Gary, most of the vets that he works with do get closure on the claims that they file in a reasonable amount of time.
We have a pretty high success rate if there's any evidence out there to try to get someone service-connected.
This is because VSOs like Glover know what they're doing. They know the name of the forms, the right office to call, the dense jargon. Glover sees a disconnect between, on the one hand, capable bureaucrats getting several thousand Alaskan vets through the claims process, and, on the other, a frustrated segment of veterans with a poor understanding of the complicated system. Glover says the VA has to be rigorous, scrutinizing benefits claims because every tax dollar that they spend is under a microscope. And because their job is to dissect each claim that's made, they can't serve as an impartial advocate for an individual veteran's case. That is where the VSOs come in. Glover says if you're not navigating benefits claims every single day, it can seem like an unreasonably complex system.
It's very complicated. There are many different diseases or conditions or injuries, and so it's not a very simple process, and it'd be hard to simplify that.
Glover adds that the Anchorage VA office does not have enough VSOs. It can be a long wait getting a claim like Scott's seen all the way through, even with a knowledgeable advocate. In 2013, the average time to complete a disability claim was 387 days. When I followed up with Scott, he told me that now that he knows his service treatment record exists, he'll apply again for benefits, but the timeline and the complexity don't leave him feeling optimistic. He quit smoking, but otherwise his health has gotten worse, and he says he doesn't have much hope that things will get better. In Anchorage, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
A second person has been arrested in connection to Monday's double homicide in West Anchorage. 26-year-old Linda Chattel was taken into custody last night and is charged with second-degree murder, manslaughter, and misconduct involving a controlled substance. 31-year-old Megan Pugh, who is already in custody, says the incident is the result of a drug deal gone bad. Pugh is also charged with second-degree murder, manslaughter, and misconduct involving a controlled substance. The deceased are 33-year-old Robin Porter, who was Pugh's husband, and 22-year-old Jeremiah Taluga. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a popular pre-kindergarten program is cut from the governor's budget proposal.
For 6.5 hours a day, people can go to work knowing that their kid is safe and receiving some education while they're going to work.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Did you know the average cost of a DUI in Alaska is over $24,000? Each December, there is a spike in impaired driving-related accidents. Consider the real costs of driving impaired. It could result in the loss of your hard-earned money, your job, or worse, you could lose your life. The Alaska Highway Safety Office reminds you to drive sober or get pulled over. This message sponsored by the Alaska Highway Safety Office.
All of the state's 39 courthouses will be closed tomorrow, Christmas Eve, as a cost-saving measure while the state tries to chip away at a multi-billion dollar budget deficit. KTOO's Matt Miller has the report.
All of the judicial branch's 750 employees and all 73 judges and justices are being furloughed for one day or being required to take mandatory leave without pay on Thursday, Christmas Eve.
We're doing our part.
Communications Counsel Mara Rabinowitz says they're saving a total of over $500,000 with the Christmas Eve closure and a previous closure on the day after Thanksgiving.
These are days that are associated with long holiday weekends, and they're days that we anticipate will have less of an impact on accessibility to the courts. They're days that are typically we see lower volumes.
Court employees and judges, which are not represented by a bargaining unit, will still be available for emergency proceedings like search warrant and mental health involuntary commitment applications, in-custody arraignments, domestic violence petitions, and emergency child in need of aid hearings. Supreme Court Chief Justice Craig Stowers wrote to employees last month that salaries and benefits make up over three-quarters of the court system's current $113 million budget. He says there are no other options for absorbing a $3.5 million cut. Justices decided the best opportunity for savings would come from mandatory unpaid leave, closing courthouses on selected days, and leaving positions unfilled after an employee quits or retires. Mara Rabinowitz says a court employee advisory committee favored pay cuts and unpaid leave over potential layoffs.
They're carefully considered strategies for how to preserve jobs, avoid layoffs, while still providing our core mission of accessibility to courts for fair and impartial resolution of disputes.
Stowers says some employees have already voluntarily taken additional leave without pay. He's also asking all judges to take 6 days of leave or forego an improved 2.5% pay raise. And to set an example, Stowers says he already had 12 days pay deducted from his $205,000 a year salary. Courthouses will also be closed on the last Friday next March, April, and May. Then, after another round of expected cuts goes into effect next July, courthouses will close early every Friday at noon. If next fiscal year's cuts do not exceed 3.5%, then court employees will get an extra half hour in their Monday through Thursday workdays. Within the executive branch, a couple hundred employees from the State Departments of Administration, Law, and Natural Resources are also being furloughed on Thursday. The estimated savings totals just over $650,000.
Each of those departments had some budget issues with the cuts that they've been taking, and that's just one of the ways they chose to solve their budget issues.
Deputy Administration Commissioner Leslie Rydell says they're sending home non-represented employees, such as those who work in the commissioner's or attorney general's office, division directors, and state attorneys and public defenders. The judicial branch receives only a small fraction, not even 1.5% of state general funds. That's in contrast to the executive branch, which makes up over 86% of the $8.2 billion state operating budget. Meanwhile, there are roughly 15,000 other employees statewide who will likely be paid a full day's wage on Thursday. Many state office workers could be sent home early if Governor Bill Walker continues with the common Christmas Eve tradition established by previous governors. Reporting in Juneau, I'm Matt Miller.
The governor's proposed budget calls for the elimination of a $2 million pre-kindergarten program, which serves six school districts in Anchorage, Juneau, and Western Alaska. KDLG's Hannah Colton has more.
Alaska was one of just 12 states in the U.S. without state-funded pre-K when it started a pilot program in 2009. The pre-kindergarten program is free to qualifying low-income families, and according to Deputy Education Commissioner Les Morse, has seen considerable success in its six-year run.
There is solid data around its success. We specifically looked at various different kinds of assessments on students in terms of their performance, as well as the delivery of program by the districts. It actually has been very successful. The largest problem with the program is that we really haven't been able to grow it. So it really continues to serve at the same number of students and the same dollar figure that it served during its pilot stage.
Morse says the original plan was to expand the program after a few years. But according to the National Institute for Early Education Research, it never reached more than 3% of four-year-olds in the state. About 40 of those toddlers are in the Lower Kuskokwim School District. Early childhood coordinator April Blevins says the pilot program has been the most accessible of the programs offered to low-income families in her district.
There are programs, but it's like grant-funded programs that these parents have to apply with this huge application, and it usually discourages people from going that route, whereas applying for the pilot program is very simple.
The program is also in demand. Blevins says the pre-K serves 28 children in Bethel, 5 in Tununic, and 9 in Akyuk. She has another 30 kids on a waiting list. And besides providing education from certified teachers, Blevins says the pre-K program fills another need in communities where reliable childcare can be nearly impossible to find.
For 6.5 hours a day, people can go to work knowing that their kid is safe and receiving some education while they're going to work. I've had parents cry. It's pretty emotional sometimes because it's the first time they've been able to go back to work because they've been watching their child because there is no childcare. So I think sometimes there's some underlying emotions that people don't realize how the program affects their lives.
In 2014, nearly 5 times as many 4-year-olds in the state were enrolled in Head Start programs as the pre-K program. 3/4 of all 4-year-olds were not served by either Head Start or pre-K. The governor's proposed education budget would also delete $820,000 in grants for other early childhood programs, and it would reduce funding for the Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program by $385,000. Right now, it's still early in the budget cycle. Lawmakers will have a chance to weigh in during the regular session next month. In Dillingham, I'm Hannah Colton.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
the Red Dog Mine, committed to environmental excellence.
Alaska Pacific University delivers a distinctive education grounded in real-world experience. Through their engaging staff and faculty, APU's education is designed to broaden and deepen their students' potential through action and understanding. Hashtag, this is our classroom. This message sponsored by APU.
There were a total of 44 commercial fishing openers for coho and chum in the Yukon River, most of which were held in the lower river districts. Commercial fishermen harvested more than 191,000 chum and a record-breaking 129,700 coho salmon, raking in a total of almost $1.5 million. That was part of the findings by the Alaska Department of Fish and Game in the 2015 season summary for the Yukon River salmon fishery. Wildlife managers say lower than average coho numbers were observed passing the sonar at Pilot Station. They also say the only coho escapement goal in the Yukon at the Delta Clearwater River was exceeded, with more than 19,000 cohos estimated to have made it to their spawning grounds. The drainage-wide escapement goal of between 300,000 and 600,000 chum salmon was met with an estimated escapement of 450,000 chum. ADF&G says there was no report on king or red salmon escapement, and there was limited information on coho spawning activities due to a lack of data and funding. A report on the subsistence harvest is still pending. Mike Romine is a Sitka man with a love of Christmas lights. His home has become an attraction every December with its huge displays coordinated to musical hits such as Uptown Funk. But this season, as Sitkans work to recover from a deadly natural disaster, the lights hold a special meaning. KCAW's Brielle Schaefer has the story.
In the daytime, Mike Romine's house on Wachusett Street looks like a Christmas wonderland. Big inflatable snowmen and penguins repurposed from bowling pins adorn his yard. But that isn't even the real show. At around 4 o'clock every afternoon, the magic happens. Romine, with 4 separate controllers, hits the buttons to make all of his seasonal tableaus glow.
Okay, Simon? Okay, Theodore?
That's it, that's everything.
The crowning glory of his display are strings of LED lights in the shape of a Christmas tree. They flash pictures set to music he plays from a speaker outside his house. He also transmits it on an FM frequency so people can hear it in their cars.
This is a really dark time of year in Sitka, and you know, when you're out riding around, you see a big house lit up, it just brings a smile to your face every time.
A commercial and charter fisherman, Romine says his display gives him something to do in the off season. And he says he's always enjoyed the seasonal decorations.
When I bought this house, I had a big yard, and I remembered when I was a kid, all of us piling into the car and riding around looking at Christmas lights.
Romine's display is especially poignant this year. As you watch the lights climb up the tallest part of the tree, they form words. The date, August 18th, when 7 landslides struck in the Sitka area. And then the names, Elmer and Ulysses Diaz and William Stortz, the 3 individuals who lost their lives that day.
That's us thinking of you and your families. I just knew that there was a lot of people that affected. I mean, that Sitka really came together. It was a pretty big deal. And so, you know, I thought just showing that, you know, I was thinking of them, you know, it probably means that most of Sitka probably is too. And I think the families have appreciated it.
Although it might be best described as public art now, Romine's display started modestly 8 years ago and over time grew to take over his whole yard. Perhaps the most popular addition is a new song for his light tree and an illuminated Santa design grooving to the beat.
I get a real kick out of, you know, every time I look out my window, there's people out here dancing and stuff like that. So it's a lot of fun.
The lights are quite the town attraction. While traffic can get backed up into the roundabout right outside Romine's house, his neighbors are okay with it, at least for the month. Here's Noah Shepherd.
You know, it's holiday season. You got to kind of roll with it.
On a recent evening, several people cruised by in cars to watch the lights. Jada Smith was with her family, including her granddaughter, 2-year-old JC. They stopped by after a concert at Blatchley Middle School.
It's fantastic. The baby loves it. We all do. It's a nice Christmas evening.
All in all, Romine estimates the spectacle has 7,000 lights. During the month of December, he says he doesn't even look at his electricity bill.
We have it on prepay with the city on a credit card. So, you know, it's only for a month and it's not that big a deal. So I don't really worry about it.
He says the cost is well worth it to see and hear from people like Smith and baby JC, who are delighted with the show.
Ooh.
Reporting in Sitka, I'm Brielle Schaefer.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at alaskapublic.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Lisa Fu and Matt Miller in Juneau, Josh Edge and Zachariah Hughes in Anchorage, Hannah Colton in Dillingham, Charles Enoch in Bethel, and Brielle Schaefer in Sitka. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, Monica Goki is our web editor, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Condor Airlines, with nonstop service from Ted Stevens International Airport to Germany and beyond. More information available on condor.com. Condor, born to fly. Did you know the average cost of a DUI in Alaska is over $24,000? Well, each December, there's a spike in impaired driving-related accidents, so consider the real cost of driving impaired. Could result in a loss of your hard-earned money, your job, or worse, you could lose your life. The Alaska Highway Safety Office reminds you to drive sober or get pulled over. This message sponsored by the Alaska Highway Safety Office.
If you're a rural Alaska resident with an interest in preserving subsistence hunting, trapping, and fishing for future generations, and maintaining an open forum for public expressions, opinions, and concerns regarding subsistence, consider applying for a seat on the Federal Subsistence Regional Advisory Council by Friday, January 29, 2016. More information at 1-800-456 or email subsistence@fws.gov. This message sponsored by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.